Without any further ado, patiently holding is our usual Tuesday. Always glad to have him, stirring up trouble. The Boyack Review, maybe I should call it Connor the Gadfly. Connor, are you there?
I am, Jake. How's it going?
It's going good. So you sent me a message. You wanted to talk about maybe people should let the federal government stuff go and focus more on local government. Is that kind of where you want to go?
Yeah, you know, I get a lot of questions from people who are looking to become more politically involved, and they ask, you know, what can I do, where should I spend my time and my money, and how can I make a difference? And yet, it's interesting, you know, the same people are gravitate so much and are so interested in national news and current events. And certainly there's no fault in that. Clearly they're important and very horrible things to worry about and fret over and try and make a difference on. But to me, it's interesting that collectively we've gravitated towards a higher level where local or state issues are a lot more neglected. They don't get as much play. They don't get as much attention. In my experience, I've kind of gone through this own shift that leads me to the answer that I usually give these people. I was the same way, and I was always trying to, you know, make a difference at the federal level, what little, you know, one person can, and very worried about what Congress was doing. I was on Mike Lee's Senate campaign, you know, in the last go-around 2 years ago.
Sure, which is kind of a federal-level type of approach.
Mm-hmm, right, trying to get a good candidate, the nomination for his party, so he could go make a difference and try and dethrone Bob Bennett, who was awful. And so I really believe, and still do largely to a certain degree, that it's important to make a difference at the federal level and do what you can. But a few months after that, I started going through this transformation where I had the epiphany that my time was not nearly as productively spent as it could have been. And it was at that time that I became more involved, and I'm now the chair for the Utah 10th Amendment Center. And the goal of the 10th Amendment Center, of course, as your listeners I'm sure all know, the 10th Amendment says that any power is not delegated to the federal government or reserved to the states and the people, respectively. And the goal with our organization is to try and help the states and encourage them to fight back at the state level to push back against an encroaching and unconstitutional federal government. And it really opened up the floodgates for me to realize that I was able to much better leverage my time, my resources, to make a difference by working at the state line, at the state level, rather than at the federal level, where it is downright near impossible unless you have significant amounts of money or connections to be able to make a substantive difference. And so what I now tell people that I've seen in my own life and in just the past couple of years, that you are able to make much greater an impact if you try and get changes done at the state level. For example, you know, I'm connected to half of the legislature on Facebook. They're very open. They're very accessible. It's very easy to talk with and connect with legislators. It's very easy to find one to run a bill that you're interested in, whether you want to draft it yourself, as I have in a couple cases, or if you just have an idea and you say, what do you think about this? And you find a willing legislator who then has the legislative council, the office of attorneys at the legislature, then draft the bill. It's very easy with the caucus convention system that Utah has to become a delegate. We've got the caucuses for the two major parties, at least, and some of the others as well, coming up in just a couple of weeks, where you can become a delegate. You can have a much greater impact in determining who within the party that you're in will be able to get the nomination and thus become a legislator. It's easy to run for office yourself. It doesn't take a lot of money. And really anyone is able to do it. So I personally believe now, and I've really seen the difference in my own life, that the way to fight against bad government is not only to clean up shop internally, right? I mean, pushing back against the federal government is only one aspect of it. We need to clean house here in Utah. There's all sorts of bad stuff that we need to happen. But when someone is a Utah legislator, when you have a legislator's ear, not only can you encourage them to try and improve things internally here in Utah, but that, I believe, is the most effective way to fight back against the federal government, as we're seeing with states that are, nullified Obamacare. We had the Firearms Freedom Act a couple of years ago in Utah, these intrastate commerce type of actions. We've had states fight against the TSA.
Well, and, like, look at our Utah Sound Money Act, which has been huge.
Sound Money Act is a great example. Most recently, we've had almost a dozen states stand up to the 2012 NDAA to either nullify or strongly object to the power claimed now by the president to indefinitely detain American citizens with no due process. it is the state line that is the most effective way to try and fight back against that. Because if you want to do a lawsuit in court, you know, you're suing the federal government by using a branch of the federal government. It doesn't often work out very well in your favor and costs a lot of money. Trying to change Congress is a downright impossible task with the incumbency reelection rate in the high 90th percentile. And so really the state line is where it's at. It's where I encourage people to get involved. It's where I've seen the greatest ability to affect change. And really anyone who's looking to get involved, I think we get a much bigger bang for our buck when we work at the state level rather than being so preoccupied with the federal government, which in many ways I liken unto rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. I mean, you look at how unsustainable our debt is, at the massive interventions abroad that we're doing. You look at civilizations throughout history that followed a related pattern, and the course is clear. Unless, you know, someone like a Ron Paul were to be elected to have any drastic change, the course is clear. We're heading for the iceberg. Better, in my opinion, to work here at a more local level to prepare our state, our communities against the problems that we're going to face ahead, rather than trying to waste our time influencing the federal behemoth that you're probably not going to be able to have much impact on.
Well, and I think this is a good point. I think it's totally relevant for kind of what we're talking about today, because you're not discouraging necessarily people from focusing on federal issues, but more of a, like, stop being distracted by it and realize your time, from your experience, and you've shaked things up pretty well. You've done well, and if people want to do a similar thing, they might listen to heed your advice, that maybe the time is better spent not at the federal level, but at the state level. And I agree. I think that we have to be careful. We have to make sure not to discourage people. We have to let them go where their strengths lie. But yeah, a lot of people just forget about the power of the state nullification in the 10th Amendment. Come on back, guys. We're right in the middle of the Boyack Review. We've got Connor Boyack talking about supporting and getting involved with local government versus the federal stuff. Come on back.
Over 20 million Americans suffer from a life-threatening health risk known as obstructive sleep apnea. For people with OSA, snoring through a bad night's sleep can contribute to heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, stroke, sexual dysfunction, and shorten your lifespan by 8 to 10 years. You need Dr. Miles Preble, the OSA dentist. He's helped hundreds of folks like you or a loved one with this problem. Call 801-278-4787. 801-278-4787. Remember, when you laugh, the world laughs with you. Snore, and you sleep alone.
Now, Mr. and Mrs. Sir Galahad, what seems to be the problem?
Ever since he rescued me from the dragon, we've been drifting apart.
Well, this isn't a fairy tale.
Mr. Sir Galahad, maybe if you started by just holding Mrs. Sir Galahad's hand.
Really?
Yeah, try it. Careful, little oil.
Marriage, you're never too far apart when you're still holding hands. From your neighbors, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. For more tips on strengthening your marriage, visit family.mormon.org.
Disney on Ice presents Disney Pixar's Toy Story 3. The toys are back in town.
I'm back. Where have I been?
In an action-packed adventure that takes you
to infinity
and beyond.
Catch the excitement when Buzz Lightyear, Woody, and the Toy Story gang take over the ice.
The fun begins at $13 for tickets. Additional fees may apply. See smithstix.com for details. The most Toy Story fun on ice is playing Energy Solutions Arena March 7th through 11th. Get your tickets today at smithstix.com.
The voice of Utah, AM 630 K-Talk.
K-Talk.com.
Number one for the most live, local, two-way talk.
Talk. Talk to each other and talk.
All right, guys, welcome back. Mental Self-Defense Radio. I am Jake Shannon, right in the middle of the Boyack Review. Connor Boyack is on the line with us, talking about getting involved at the local level. Now, this kind of makes me wonder about something, Connor, and your view, because you know, as your involvement with the Utah 10th Amendment Center, what is the answer when we've got a bit of a civil war between the feds and the state, like medical marijuana, for example? California is legal, and yet right. The feds keep going in and doing these smash and grabs. I mean, it seems to be jockeying for power, and the feds seem to be outgunning us.
You know, it's a great tie-in to a story I wanted to share, and I think this directly answers your question, which, as I understand it, is namely what can be done when you're pitting the people and hopefully sometimes at least the states against the federal government. We often praise Thomas Jefferson, right? This great man who was a pioneer of individual liberty, and we revere him rightly so, I think, for his great contributions, including the Declaration of Independence. You know, but when he became president, as was the case with many of the founders, he was not perfect, nor were his actions entirely consistent with his previously espoused philosophy of what government should be. There was an instance in 1807, the Napoleon Wars were going on. Britain and France are fighting, and they start basically taking over American ships overseas and impressing Americans into their own militaries. It was a very controversial and heated time. And rather than fighting a war with these people, he decided for economic warfare. And he passed and encouraged to be passed and then signed an embargo in 1807. Many of the states found this unconstitutional. They found it very problematic, especially the New England states that were primarily, they had maritime commerce. These were the eastern states that had a lot of ships coming in and out. They suffered the most. And it was really interesting. In 2 years later, Massachusetts was one of the states that stood up. And their legislature, they condemned the embargo in no uncertain terms. They said this. They said that they condemned the embargo as, in many respects, unjust, oppressive, and unconstitutional, and not legally binding on the citizens of this state. But then it went a step further. Not only did it object, because we have many states objecting to Real ID and to NDAA and Obamacare. There's plenty of kind of positioning and chest thumping. What's interesting about Massachusetts in this case is that the legislature said they went even further and said this: it would be derogatory to the honor of this state to presume that it is unable to protect its subjects against all violations of their rights by peaceable and legal remedies. While this state maintains its sovereignty and independence, all the citizens can find protection against outrage and injustice in the strong arm of the state government. So they're basically saying, we're going to put our money or whatever other, political future, even the risking their own political future, on the line to stand by what we're saying, what we're objecting to, and we're going to absolutely refuse to comply and even try and hedge up the way for the federal government to be able to enforce this embargo. They weren't the only state. There was Connecticut, the governor, Jonathan Trumbull. He said this to his legislature. He called a special session and encouraged the legislature to pass legislation, which they then passed a very excellent resolution. You can read this, by the way, in Tom Wood's book, Nullification. He covers these things in detail. This was the state of Connecticut, mind you, again, opposing Thomas Jefferson, kind of the Mr. Individual Liberty. And nevertheless, this is what the governor of Connecticut said. He said, whenever our national legislature is led to overleap the prescribed bounds of their constitutional powers, on the state legislatures in great emergencies, devolves the arduous task. It is their right, it becomes their duty, to interpose their protecting shield between the right and liberty of the people and the assumed power of the general or federal government. So we have these examples, and of course previously Jefferson himself had kind of formulated what we now call the Principles of 1798, where in the resolutions of Kentucky and Virginia, they opposed the actions of John Adams with the Alien and Sedition Act. And now Jefferson was feeling the brunt of his own principles just about a decade later. I think that's what we need to answer your question directly, Jake. We don't need some chest thumping. Gary Herbert, our governor, has from time to time kind of postured himself as a chest thumper as well. We need someone who has the spine to stand up and absolutely refuse to comply with a blatantly and clearly unconstitutional mandate. We need a legislature, we need a governor, we need an attorney general who aren't just going to say these words, especially during election season, to appeal to the delegates here in Utah. We need someone kind of like a Chris Christie, but I think a little bit more principled and rigid on what should and should not be done. He's got some bad policies, but I think that's a good example of someone using their bully pulpit to really shake things up.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's kind of the point that I've been trying to make, that we need, and I really don't like going to Ron Paul all the time, because he's not going to be around forever. If he doesn't win, he's retiring, and we need to get other people involved, but we do need kind of our own Ron Pauls at every level. We need hardcore principled libertarians at the state level, at the federal level, in media, in our schools, in our businesses, across the board.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And really, the only reason that these type of actions were taken by these states whether Kentucky and Virginia in 1798 or Massachusetts and Connecticut and other states years later applying these same principles and firmly objecting to the federal government, we need principled people. That doesn't necessarily they need to be members of any given party. They need to be committed and consistent people who understand the principles of liberty, and whether it's someone in their own party who is passing a horrible piece of legislation or someone who they feel they owe a political favor for previously supporting something, we need someone who's going to cast aside all that political tomfoolery and instead rigidly adhere to the principles that should be codified into, you know, local municipal law, state law, federal law. We've so severely deviated from that, like I said, at the federal level, it feels like we're just on the Titanic. I do think that fighting back at the state level, as was the case historically with these examples and others, as can be the case now, it does work. It has worked. People say, well, nullification, you know, it would cause civil war. No. We got the federal government to back down in 2005 from Real ID because over two dozen states stood up and refused to comply. It wasn't called nullification at the time. That wasn't really part of the you know, political lexicon until a few years later when Tom Woods and others have started now writing books on it and bringing it up to our consciousness. But it was nullification. It was states absolutely refusing to comply, whether through a resolution or an outright piece of legislation, which would be direct nullification, or even lawsuits. The federal government, they passed the law, right? It was still on the books, but they couldn't enforce it because they didn't want to risk, as you mentioned earlier, this outright conflict with the states. They wanted to bide their time. They lost the game of chicken. Now, of course, they're coming back out and they're working through kind of side attacks to get Real ID still enforced and get states to bend into compliance. But to the extent that we're able to infuse the state legislatures around the country and the governor's office and the attorneys general with principled individuals who aren't going to back down a couple years after the wind blows over on an issue or because of any other circumstance, who are going to fight for these things, I think that's where we stand the best chance. That's where I think many of these founders understood the fight to be. There was a great quote from Jefferson, of course, imperfect as he was, as I just suggested, with his embargo policy. But he said this, which I find to be a great quote: "When all government, domestic and foreign, in little as in great things, shall be drawn to Washington as the center of all power, it will render powerless the checks provided of one government on another, and will become as venal and oppressive as the government from which we separated." I think we now have the fulfillment of that, and I think we need to reintroduce the balanced federalism at a minimum between the states and the federal government that once existed, and that requires, as I said at the outset of the segment, working through the state legislatures, the state governments to reintroduce that balance and scale back forcefully if necessary, not armed force, I'm not talking about violence, but through direct confrontation and challenge to federal power. We need to do that through the vehicle of the state. I think that's where we can be effective. I think that's where we can actually get some results.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's not just at the state level, but, I mean, the importance of this kind of stuff with regards to enforcement, I mean, it really falls back on a mutual acquaintance of ours, and that is a guy like Richard Mack at the sheriff, at the county level, and the importance of electing a pro-liberty sheriff.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. He just created some organization, I don't remember the name, trying to gather county sheriffs across the nation to help them understand their constitutional role, their constitutional ability and authority to basically eject any federal agent or officer who was trying to enforce something that was unconstitutional. It's basically, I take the standpoint of let's throw the mud up against the wall and see what sticks. I'm not against lawsuits. I'm against lawsuits as the only method of fighting against the federal government. Let's do lawsuits. Let's do nullification. Let's pass a resolution. Let's get the county sheriffs to get involved. Let's get municipal governments to object, like we had in Highland a couple months ago. They passed an ordinance objecting to the federal regulation of intrastate, or in their case, inner city food that was grown by their residents. They said there's no federal oversight. This is, you know, if they're eating it and growing it and all on their own, then the federal government has no authority. We basically need any level of government to fight for liberty, whatever, you know, spheres of influence they have, whatever the circumstances are, and then we see what works. But I think we need to build like this rising tidal wave of opposition to what the federal government is doing. I don't think there's one single method that's better than the other. I think we need to employ every ability, every circumstance, every opportunity that we can to fight back.
But even like, say you just even run. I mean, Ron Paul, his presidential aspirations have been rather dismal. Dealing factually with the facts, 1988, 2008, this year he did much better, but probably still going to be Romney. However, that's just the battle. The war is where Ron Paul has won because he's run. He actually has run. And people were talking about these issues, and they never would have before. And the funny thing is getting involved at whatever level people get involved with, whether it's supporting a candidate, whether it's running yourself, at least you're getting involved and people are talking about the issues that are really important. And as pro-liberty people, we have to do that at whatever level we can.
I think you're exactly right to draw the distinction between battles and wars, right? This has been something that's been two centuries in the making. This is a generational conflict that we're not going to get out of simply by passing a bill next year at the Utah state level, for example. It is something that's generational. I think we see a lot of more liberty-minded people in the rising generation. People say, well, youthful people are always idealistic. But I go to, you know, rallies and events, and I talk to people who are my age or younger, and it's fascinating to watch them quote some of the greatest philosophers and economic thinkers of the ages, to be able to quote specific Federal Reserve policy and history and things. You know, it's a disservice for many people, as they seemingly do, to disregard these more libertarian-leaning youth as pot-smoking hippies that just want the freedom to do whatever they want. I think that is a fundamental misunderstanding of what so many of these young people want. They, or in many cases, what they don't want. They don't want the debt. They don't want the wars. They don't want a government that is oppressing them. And so I think there's great hope in the rising generation. You know, clearly we have our bad apples. There are people who want to be free just to, you know, do bad things. But when I see the especially with the blessing of the internet, good heavens, being able to see these people research such specific minutiae of history and economics and philosophy and be willing and ready and able to apply that in the public sphere, I think 5, 10, 20 years from now, we're going to have a slow and subtle but significant revolution, an ideological revolution that hopefully we will be able to infuse the state levels, as I say, and push back against the federal government. I'm, you know, as bad as things are, as close as the Titanic of the federal government is to the iceberg, I'm very hopeful. I think we right now is an excellent time for the liberty movement. I think we have had no better time, really, to kind of explode this out into the public sphere. I'm very excited for the next few years to see what happens.
Yeah, that's why I stand firmly opposed to all the fear-mongers. And there's a lot of them that are, again, on our side. I'm thinking of guys like, you know, Alex Jones or something or whatever. Or even, Glenn Beck's not on our side. But, you know, that fear-mongering kind of stuff. And I'm with it, fine. Maybe you're hitting some segment that resounds with. But, I mean, the real fact is we have every reason to be totally optimistic. And for me, I don't think we're going to miss the iceberg, but what that's going to allow us to do is have smarter people rebuild the Titanic and smarter people at the helm that won't drive us into an iceberg of debt. That I'm with you. I think people are, like you said, by nature good. And again, looking at psychopath statistics, it's 1-2% of any population. That means there's 9 for every 100, there's 99 or 98 good people. The problem is that those psychopaths are drawn to positions of power. So we've got to wisen up the other 99% with regards to that, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing it beginning to happen. I mean, I know many people who are running for, you know, state legislator and things, and they may not be as popular or well-funded enough, but they're willing to do it. They're willing to stand up. And I think, again, years down the road, this movement is only going to get bigger and better. Again, as people talk to me and solicit my input on the matter, I say, you know, don't worry about getting on a federal campaign. Don't worry about donating too much of your money and time to things of that nature. Really try and apply it for where you can get the most return on your investment. I really think that's at the state level.
Now, speaking of that, people should check out, what is it, wearearewarlikepeople.org or
it's,
.com?
Warlikepeople.com.
Okay, check it out, guys. It's Connor's new project, always stirring up trouble. Love it. Hey, Connor, thanks for a great segment.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.